why don't you download my blog? It's free. Of course, we do appreciate donations.
In ancient times, the Mayan people were the first civilization to discover that this planet had an expiration date. According to their calendar, in the year 2012, a cataclysmic event will unfold caused by an alignment of the planets in our solar system that only happens every 640,000 years.
Oh, not again.
That, of course, was actor Woody Harrelson playing a man obsessed with the end of the world in the film 2012. Most casual observers of Maya culture know of it only in terms of that rumored prophecy that the end of the world is at hand, and that we know this because of a Maya calendar, the so-called long count calendar. But there is so much more to know about the Maya. Joining us now to share just a bit of his knowledge is Michael Deco. He's a professor emeritus of anthropology at Yale University, where he is also curator emeritus at the Peabody Museum of Natural History. He's written many books, including the Maya 8th edition, Breaking the Maya Code, and The True History of Chocolate. His most recent is The Royal Cities of the Ancient Maya. Welcome to the show, Michael Coe.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's talk about that Mayan calendar, or calendars. Serious scholars have been debunking the idea of apocalypse associated with the calendar for years, but the rumors persist, as you well know. So what is the significance? What are these calendars or calendar? What is it about?
Well, firstly, about the long count. That is a day-to-day count. It's sort of like what astronomers use, where they don't have to bother about new leap years or any of the other complications of calendars. Just a day-to-day-to-day count. Our current cycle began on a day, we say August 13th, 3114 B.C. At least that's what the Maya thought it began on. And it continues just a day-to-day-to-day-to-day count until you reach its culmination. This count operated with cycles of different lengths, and you basically, in a typical Maya date, long count date, you added up all of these. You multiplied the cycles by their coefficients, and then you added all of this up, and you reach the current date, or perhaps a date into the future. This particular calendar has a super cycle that's 13 times a baktun. A baktun is the count of 144,000 days. So if you multiply 13 times 144,000 days, and then divide the result by the length of a year, 365 and a quarter approximately, you come out to a cycle of 5,125 and a quarter years. This is going to culminate very shortly, if not tomorrow. Most of the pros in this field say it's going to be December 23rd, not December 21st. And actually, very recently, it was posted on the Internet, a thing by two really reputable scholars in this field, that says Christmas Eve is going to be at the 24th. It depends on the correlation between our calendar and the Maya calendar. But these are all, you know, differing by 1, 2, or 3 days. We all agree that this is going to come to an end. And the question is, what happens after that?
Right. Is there a kernel of truth to the rumors? In other words, is there something about that calendar and what it's supposed to do that would give rise to these rumors?
Well, it's amazing. Some of the hypotheses, I won't glorify them with
right.
the term theory, how these things have popped up. You know, about there's something to do with a galactic center and things like that. That's all completely blarney. No serious Mayanist, specialist in Maya culture, believes such stuff. But it is coming to an end, and there's all of us believe, no matter whether we're the debunkum types or we think there's a kernel of truth, we all believe that there's going to be another great cycle immediately following on this, beginning when this one ends. And it will continue for another 5,125 years. A lot depends on what the Maya thought about the future and about the past. They made calculations, honestly, millions of years into the future. So it's quite clear they didn't believe time was going to come to an end. But something was going to happen. I'm positive that that's what the classic Maya believed. And I think they would have certainly marked this with some big, I won't say festivals, but perhaps rituals at this point.
My guest is Michael Coe. He's professor emeritus in anthropology at Yale University. He's written many books, including his latest, Royal Cities of the Ancient Maya. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're not my first expert on the show to talk about this, Professor Coe. Are you wearied by the conversation at this point about the calendar?
Well, the weird thing is that I'm afraid to say I started this whole thing.
What?
Back in
no one told
only
me this.
Together, back in 1966, in my general book on called The Maya, for done for Thames and Hudson in London, I put in there, this is 1966, this book came out. I put in an observation that about this particular cycle of the long count that is going to, you know, culminate in December 21st or 23rd, 2012. I thought at that point there wouldn't be anybody alive that I knew, including myself. So I just stuck it in, you know, sort of interesting. And I'm afraid to say that I even suggested the Maya might have conceived of an apocalypse coming at this point, an end of days, you know. And the reason why I said this at that time was that the Aztec very definitely had an idea that our present age is going to end in a cataclysm. And the Aztecs and Mayas are culturally rather similar to each other. So I felt this wasn't, you know, I wasn't trying to sell the book with scared tactics here, but I thought it should be pointed out that, you know, maybe some lucky baby born about that time was going to live until 2012. Little did I think that I'd be talking about it on public radio at this point. So the other thing is, did the Maya note this date at all, the culmination?
Yeah, did they write about it?
Did they write about it? And here's where you really end up with a frustration. There's only one, well, there are two now, but one famous account on a very much broken up Maya monument, stone monument, from a site called Totoquero, which is in southeastern Mexico. This site was handed over to a cement corporation, and they just ground up. They destroyed the site completely, and all the monuments were dispersed. Some of them were broken. One of them has been put together, Monument 6 from Totoquero, and it does have that date on it. And the dates are always followed by a verb that tells you what's going to happen on that date, and then something, who are the protagonists? It seems it's quite destroyed. It's very difficult to read it, but it seems like the verb is somebody descends at this point. A god descends. And the god is a very enigmatic guy called Bolon Yocte, which means something like nine strides. We don't know much about him, but we do know that he comes down at great intervals like this. He came down at the creation of this particular world that's supposedly going to end. We've got his name there in one particular inscription, back actually on a Maya vase, and it's now in the Art Institute of Chicago. Wonderful piece that shows the beginning of this world in darkness. And if he's going to come down, they must have thought, again, they must have thought that there was something going to happen that is going to destroy the world.
Are there any other Maya predictions out there, or
well, there
that,
are...
that could give credence to any of this, or that we should, you know?
Well, let me say, I know my colleagues will be furious at me when I say that there's something in this. I mean, there would have been something in this if the classic Maya civilization had continued. It ended around 900 AD. The last long count monument in the Maya calendar is 909 AD. I just saw it a few weeks ago in a museum in Mexico. And I think they would have worried about this. If the classic Maya were still going, which they're not. There are mm-hmm. a lot of Maya, but they're not classic Maya. Mm-hmm. That civilization ended a long, long time ago. However, there are recorded in colonial times from the Highland Maya, living up in the Maya Highlands, not in the lowlands, mythologies that talk about past cataclysms. When the world was destroyed and the gods recreated, trying to get humans all the time. And these were imperfect creations, and they were destroyed. The last one by a flood. And, I'll bet you money that they thought that something was going to happen at in December 21st, 23rd, or 24th, 2012. The other thing is that there was a... There is a very astute linguist, anthropologist named Paul Sullivan, who made a wonderful study of the people in the southeastern part of the Yucatan Peninsula who still have many of the old beliefs. And they told him, this is back in the 1980s, he queried these people, said, oh, what's going to happen in the future? And they said, in the year... in Spanish, dos mil y pico, the year 2000 and a little bit further, the world is going to end, but the Maya are going to come back into their own. It's sort of like, almost like the ghost dance religion on the Western Plains. And everything will be restored. The stone feathered serpents in Chichen Itza, which is a major Maya site, are going to come to life. It's going to be a new world. They believe that something... They still do believe that something's going to happen. The problem is with the contemporary Maya, they all know about all of this 2012 nuttiness that's on the internet and in splat films and so forth. In fact, everybody in the world knows about this now. I was in Bali recently, and all the Balinese know about it. I mean, people who you wouldn't expect to care about it. So there's a lot of anxiety. But I wouldn't worry about it because we're not classic Maya.
My guest is Michael Coe. He's professor emeritus in anthropology at Yale University. He's an expert on Maya culture. His latest book is called Royal Cities of the Ancient Maya. If you have a question or comment for him that doesn't involve the long calendar, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to move on to further discussion about the Maya culture. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The list of current national security threats might include terrorist cells, embassy attacks, and cyber espionage. Looking ahead to the year 2030, the U.S. intelligence community warns that climate change will drive conflict, migration, and instability, and the growth of the middle class will step up competition for resources. I'm Neil Conan, Emerging Security Threats, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 46 degrees with some rain. Expect showers today, maybe a thunderstorm, and a high of 54. Also a chance of rain mixing with snow tonight, a low of 30 degrees. Expect less than an inch of accumulation of snow overnight. And a wind advisory is in effect from 4 p.m. today until 4 p.m. on Friday. 89.7 NPR News receives support from the Jazz Arts Group, ringing in the new year with a small ensemble concert led by Columbus Jazz Orchestra's Byron Stripling and Bobby Floyd, Friday, December 28th at 8 p.m. at the Lincoln Theater. Tickets and details at jazzartsgroup.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Michael Coe. He's professor emeritus in anthropology at Yale University. He's also an expert on Maya culture. We are inspired to talk to him today because tomorrow, according to, certain people believe that the long calendar of the Maya indicates that tomorrow might be the end of the world. We thought we'd squeeze in Michael Coe real quick before that happens. But all joking aside, we want to talk about Maya culture with Professor Coe. If you have a question about the culture, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Professor Coe, how much do we really know about the Maya? And I know that's the kind of a how do you measure something like that, but how much do we know? Do you feel comfortable with how much we know?
We know more about the Maya than about any other ancient culture in the pre-Spanish New World, pre-Columbian New World. And the reason why we know so much is that we can now read what they had to say about themselves, about their own history. And that wasn't always the case. This great decipherment, as I would call it, took place or has taken place only in the last 25 or 30 or 40 years. Before that, nobody could read what was on these monuments except for the dates, including the long count date. So this has allowed us to actually hear their own voices speaking about the things that concern them. Now, a lot of these are these writings are on public monuments. In stone, in their great cities. We only have four of their bark paper books, folding screen books on bark paper that are left, but these are from very late times. All the rest were destroyed at the end of the Classic period, which took place between 800 and 900 AD. So we know a lot about them that we didn't know before. And there's been a huge amount of archaeology done in all of these Maya sites. We know when Maya culture developed. We know how these city-states got along or didn't get along with each other, about royal marriages, births, deaths, wars. And there's a lot known about the Maya. There's a huge amount. This is probably the most complicated and I will say advanced culture ever developed in the New World prior to 1492. And it takes a lifetime really of study to really absorb everything that we currently know about these people. So they're unusual, but there's a lot of very smart people who have been studying them over the last 100 or 150 years. So I'd say we know a lot about them.
What was the breakthrough that led to the deciphering?
Well, there were actually kind of a double breakthrough. One was what are these writings about that are on these thousands of stone monuments? And that breakthrough was a very ingenious one, mainly by an exiled Russian scholar named Tatyana Proskuryakov, who discovered and proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that they were writing their own history, the story of their conquests and the royal marriages, accessions to the throne, and things of that nature. And that was one side of the breakthrough. What's it all about? The other side is, how do you read it in a Maya language? And the great figure in that was another Russian, this time stuck in the Soviet Union. In 1952, a young scholar named Yuri Knorozov, and he discovered the phonetic basis of Maya writing, that they had a combined this with what we would call meaning signs or logographic signs, rather complex system that he worked out. So we can now read this stuff in the language that, in one of the Maya languages. There's over 29 Maya languages in the Mayan language group, and we're able now to find out what was the literary language. And it was in one of those, we call it Chaltean, one particular Mayan language. And we know the whole grammar, every last thing about that. The Maya wrote everything that was in their language. They were the only people in the New World who could do this. So we can now read this stuff. And that was an amazing breakthrough. And it's just changed the whole playing field of Maya studies.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you'd like to speak to our guest, Michael Coe, Professor Emeritus in Anthropology at Yale University. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Jay Nuba in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So I have a question for Professor Coe. So I was just wondering if you could elaborate on the greatest achievements of the Maya civilization, and can he draw any similarities, or can you draw a comparison with the Egyptian civilization, which I believe is a little older, probably?
Well, yes. The Maya are of great interest to historians of science because they had a very advanced astronomy. They didn't have a telescope, but they had naked eye astronomy. They'd taken this to a great extent, and their astronomy was on a level equivalent to that of, let's say, the ancient Babylonians, and certainly better than what the ancient Greeks had, and certainly better than what the ancient Egyptians had. They knew the exact length of the year, for instance, to what we would now call four decimal places. They knew the movements of the moon and the phases of the moon. They were very much concerned with that. They knew all of the visible planets too. They tracked that, and there are Maya calendars in their books that give you the appearance and disappearance of the planets at various times, particularly the planet Venus, the morning star and evening star. They knew that the morning star and evening star were the same body, the planet Venus, which is a lot more than the earlier Greeks knew. So yes, they were way ahead on things of that sort, on mathematics, and I might say on writing itself. There was nobody else in the New World like them.
What explanation is there for that? What kernel of change grew that sophistication?
Well, they didn't invent civilization completely out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
There's an older civilization called the Olmec, in which I've done a lot of work, in southeastern Mexico, just a little bit to the west of the area occupied by the Maya themselves. And they were the people who really invented a lot of things. But we don't know much about... We don't know much about the calendar in those days, very little about their writing, which is too bad. But it was people like the Olmec or descendants of the Olmec who invented the long count calendar that we're all talking about now,
mm-hmm.
Long before the Maya had it, and it was transmitted to the Maya. So they didn't suddenly come out of the blue. They had a background, the way we have a background in our civilization of Greece and Rome, very much so, as our founding fathers of this country drew on what they knew of Greece and Rome to make our own government. The same way the Maya knew about the Olmec, and they were heavily influenced by this heritage. But there isn't anybody else in the New World like them, that's for sure, exactly like them. There were people with related cultures, such as the Aztec, who were much, much later than what we're talking about. But they're kind of by themselves. There's no question about it. They were the only people in the New World interested in human personalities, at least as shows up in their art. They're wonderful portraits of their kings and queens. And this idea that the individual mattered is kind of unique among New World cultures, which are largely anonymous. We don't know who people were. They were really concerned with this, with their great leaders especially.
Spencer in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I had a question about the different theories behind the collapse of the classic Maya. It seems like in the past 20 years, there's been a shift to conglomerate everything into like erosion and Copan, warfare and refugees with like the Arthur Demarest theory and Washakun, maybe even water not being found readily, the power of the local elites being destroyed, so they have to find other ways. Do you see this, Professor Koh, as a maybe a shift to bring in more theories, or do you see this later on, maybe people shifting into maybe a single theory about why the civilization as a whole sort of declined?
Very good question. I see you've done your homework on this. I'm impressed. Yes, there are a lot of theories about this, but I point to what makes biological species go extinct. It's never any one thing. It's that everything piles in on them all at the same time. For instance, Atlantic salmon are really in trouble wherever they occur. It isn't just overfishing. It isn't just climate change or one thing or another. It isn't just fish farming that's doing this. It's all of these things together. And I think this is what happened to the classic Maya. They've certainly got evidence for droughts, a whole series of them at a critical time. Water shortages certainly would have been big, but of course, those people, such as the ones at Copan or on the Usumacinta River, which divides Mexico and Guatemala, that drinking water wouldn't have been a problem. It would have been for other cities. But agricultural collapse certainly did happen. There's no doubt about it. Overuse of their environment, it's an absolute perfect case of this. We have lots of evidence for this. Increased warfare that went along with this. We have all kinds of evidence for this, just absolutely berserk wars going on at the very end, before, during the period from 800 to 900 AD. All of these things just made it untenable. And then the final one, which I didn't invent, Eric Thompson, the great Mayanist, thought it up, is revolution. As part of this whole pitch, there's hardly a Maya monument or a Maya painting or a Maya building that hasn't been destroyed in some way or another. Hmm. Who did it? It's in every single city that we have, you name it. And defacement of monuments of great leaders over and over and over again, breaking up of their monuments, scratching their eyes out and their mouths out. I think there was revolutions at this time. And it was one of the greatest human tragedies of all time, what happened to these people.
And you make the point, and I did at the top, that Maya are not extinct. So there are still humans out there that are descendants.
There sure are.
But the culture is what?
Well, classic culture went, but bits of it survived. And there's 8 million, probably 8 million Maya today, many of whom, by the way, live in the United States ever since the horrible Civil War period in Guatemala. But there are survivals of many, many things that the classic Maya did that are still continued today in beliefs. It's hard to sort them out from Spanish Catholicism, though, because there is what we call syncretism. So many of the things that the Mayas were doing before the Spaniards came, ritually and their beliefs, sort of overlap with what goes on in the Catholic Church. Incense and taking of confessing and baptism, all these kinds of things were practiced by the ancient Maya before the Spaniards ever got here. So it's the anthropologist's job, maybe, to see, what is inherited from their ancestors and what came to them from the Spaniards. But they're very much alive and very much, very much on the ball if you've ever been with them.
I have. Spencer, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Grace in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome, Grace.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling to ask because I study Mayan astrology, and I was curious if doing the daykeeping would still be applicable after tomorrow.
Well, what you have to do is to get a calendar program and see about the next cycle, which is it's going to begin if it's tomorrow, if the 21st is the big date. You talk about astrology. That's the kind of astronomy that the Maya were doing certainly could be called, in a way, astrology, but it's not really like European astrology. It's got a different basis, and it's not really the what we would call judicial astrology, which is a kind of astrology that's in Europe and places like that. It didn't matter to you, to the Maya, I'm sure, which particular star group or which part of the zodiac you were born on. They had other ways of doing this. But certainly the calendar regulated, in a way, what people thought was going to happen in their lives. We know this for the Aztec. And every day that you were born was a particular day in their calendar with all kinds of auguries and I don't know what. The good news is that within these Mesoamerican cultures, as we call them, you can mitigate the bad effects of the I won't say the stars, but the planets or the calendrical days. In one way or another, you can do this. So you could sort of say, well, okay, I was born on a bad day, but you could be kind of rebaptized sometimes and get out of it that way. So it wasn't as dire as we thought. I wouldn't worry about the astrology part, but the calendar is going to keep on going. It's going to be another cycle, and it's going to go for another 5,125 and a quarter years.
Okay, so, and the archetypes will still be the same?
We have no way of knowing that. There's absolutely no way of knowing. I always tell my students, if I don't know something, and nobody knows anything, I'll say, I don't know. And here I say, I don't know.
Good policy. Grace, thanks for your call. When we will return to our conversation with Professor Michael Coe. He's professor emeritus in anthropology at Yale University. He is an expert on the Maya. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the history of how assault weapons like the semi-automatic rifle that was used in the Newtown Massacre became available on the civilian market. We talk with Tom Diaz, senior policy analyst at the Violence Policy Center and author of the forthcoming book, The Last Gun. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. WOSU Public Media is excited to announce a new weekend lineup. Listen to Radiolab every Saturday at noon. At 2 p.m., it's the Moth Radio Hour, a program dedicated to storytelling. And at 3, it's a show about fascinating ideas, the TED Radio Hour. Listen Saturdays on 89.7 NPR News, beginning January 5th. And be sure to join All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow for a discussion of surviving and coping with male sex abuse. And then join Classical 101 host Christopher Purdy and a discussion about the arts in Central Ohio with the Ballet Met, Catco Phoenix, and the OSU School of Music. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher and All Sides Weekend from 10 until noon on 89.7 NPR News. There is a wind advisory in effect from 4 p.m. today till 4 p.m. tomorrow. Expect showers and thunderstorms today and rain mixing with snow tonight, a low of 30 degrees. About an inch of accumulation is possible. Support for 89.7 comes from the members of the Trinity Episcopal Church on Capitol Square, holding a special service of Lessons and Carols, an annual festival based on the biblical service done at King's College, Cambridge. Sunday, December 23rd at 4 p.m. More at trinitycolumbus.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about the Maya culture with Michael Coe. He's professor emeritus in anthropology at Yale University and expert in the Maya culture. His latest book is called Royal Cities of the Ancient Maya. If you have a question or comment for him, we welcome them. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Mike.
Hi. Interesting subject. My question is about human sacrifice. You know, you see in the movies and read in some books that it was a major part of their culture. Was that a major portion, and what would the reasons be for the human sacrifice?
It certainly was part of the culture. There's no doubt about it, as it there was in many cultures of the old world as well as the new world. What happened was our perception of it is really clouded by what the Spanish conquistadores told us, or the missionaries. They really tried to blacken the reputation of the people that they had invaded. This started in the West Indies and continued as they conquered Mexico and Central America, everywhere, exaggerating the number of victims that were sacrificed. It was certainly formed part of their culture, but not on the scale that you get from the Spanish accounts. These accounts are just totally biased. Yes, it was important, human blood, but they sacrificed, their self-sacrifice. I don't mean committing suicide, but they, the Maya and people like them, including the Aztecs, scattered their own blood in what must have been very painful ways on paper, which was then burned to the gods. It wasn't any kind of cruelty on the part of the Mayas when they sacrificed somebody. It was considered an offering to the gods. And as far as the only real data that we have from the Maya monuments from the classic period on this shows that their people sacrificed were probably not many, and they were very important enemy leaders that they captured, kings from another kingdom, or all sorts of, court officials. And these people were definitely sacrificed. There's no question about it. The Maya like to take their heads off. Heart sacrifice is more associated with the much, much later Aztecs. They like to take their heads off. And I don't think they treated these people very well either. But we do have on the monuments depictions and mentions of this. So let's put it this way. In a restricted way, this was very important to the Maya ideas of how great leaders should keep in mind and sacrifice important things to the gods, especially above all enemies from another, high-ranking enemies from another kingdom. Yes.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Take care. What was the Maya class structure? How did they work that out?
Well, remember that all of our knowledge of the classic Maya, which really is what we're talking about, mm-hmm. Comes from these public records, these monuments that they put up, which we call stelae. Sometimes lintels over doorways, but all in stone. And like our public monuments, such as Washington or any other place, doesn't tell you much about how the people were really organized into classes or structures or different economic groupings. They don't talk much about that. They talk a lot about the elite. We do know a lot about the royal houses and about how the dynasties worked, how they became extinct or how they continued, how they intermarried between kingdoms, things of that nature, but not much about all the other people. And, of course, this is true in Egypt. It's true in the Middle East. All these true in ancient China. They're talking about themselves, that is, the elite class talking to the elite class. At the time of the conquest, there were the Bishop Landa. We got a lot of our stuff from this Franciscan bishop of Yucatan in the 16th century who described life of the times. And there was the elite at the top. There were priests. Below them were the merchants. The merchant class was very important all over Mesoamerica, actually, especially long-distance merchants. And then the ordinary people who farmed the land. On the bottom are mentioned slaves, but these were probably slaves taken in war. I don't think there was ever a hereditary slavery as we have in the old world or in pre-Civil War America. I don't think they had anything like that, but there were slaves at the bottom, and these were probably war captives, probably low-ranking ones because they hadn't been sacrificed. So that's all we know, basically, about these people. It's just not in the records.
There are three main Maya areas, the Pacific Coastal Plain, the highlands of the Chiapas in Guatemala, and the Yucatan Peninsula. How did they come to be at the same time, or how did they coalesce to form this larger culture?
Well, the only thing that you can say about them is that they all speak languages that belong to the Mayan language family, like most European languages belong to Indo-European, along with, let's say, Hindi. But so they all occupy this area today. They have different trajectories at different times, these areas. Most of what people talk about are the lowland Maya up in the Yucatan Peninsula and at the base of the peninsula in northern Guatemala. These are the people who had all these inscriptions that we can read. The highland Maya, there are very few inscriptions, except, and on the Pacific coast, the only inscriptions, and there's quite a few of them, date from before the classic Maya were really going, what we call the late pre-classic. They're very early. They sometimes have long count dates on them. We don't know a lot about those people along the Pacific slope. I began my PhD research down there. Very, very ancient villages go way, way back. Chocolate was invented by those people.
You wrote a whole book about it.
That's right. 4,000 years ago, we now know, they invented chocolate, which is a rather complex process involved in this whole thing, which became, you know, really important in all the peoples of Mesoamerica. But we just know so much more about the Yucatan Peninsula. We really do. And much, much less about the highlands and down on the coast. The irony is that most Maya speakers live in the highlands today. Some of them probably are descended from refugees from the great Maya lowland cities when the collapse occurred. They withdrew to the highlands. Some of them probably withdrew up north to northern Yucatan, but We don't know a lot about them because of the problem of lack of inscriptions.
What makes a modern Maya a Maya? How do we know they're Maya?
Well, the word Maya, actually, is almost a modern invention. The fact that all these people that we call Maya were Maya. They never called themselves this. Probably some of the peoples in Yucatan, apparently, according to really early Spanish accounts, call themselves Maya. But this word came up probably in the late 19th century by scholars, German, American, British scholars studying this area to apply to to everybody who speaks a Mayan language. And they do have a sort of a basic, a similar culture everywhere. But it's only in recent years that this pan-Maya idea has come about among the Maya themselves. There's a lot of Pan Maya feeling now. Remember that they're divided up among modern countries, but they feel an affinity to each other, and they're getting together now in a rather interesting way. So it's like the whole thing with American Indians. I mean, all of them were at each other's throats at one point, but after a while they began to coalesce, and there's a pan-Indian movement that puts on all kinds of festivals and things of that nature, and politically act together. The Maya really are sort of moving in this direction now. They're feeling an affinity to each other. They all had their own tribal names when the Spaniards arrived, like the K'iche and the Kak'ikel up in the highlands. They really were divided up into discrete groups. But today, they sort of realize that they've got things in common, and it's an interesting movement that's going on now.
In the cities that were left behind, did they leave behind burial grounds? I mean, is there human remains that have been studied?
Yes, on all levels, actually. I mean, In cities that have been really investigated in a big, big way, like Tikal in northern Guatemala, many, many burials have been found. The burials of the elite, of the royalty, of really high-ranking people, probably high-ranking scribes. The scribes were really important in these cultures. They are inside the buildings. They have buried them in tombs and then put a new structure over them, so you get a sort of a layer cake, and on every level of the layer cake, you find burials. Outside of that, in the ordinary houses of ordinary people, there are also below floor burials. Apparently, a lot of the Maya buried Dad when he conked out beneath the floor, and then probably, you know, built a new sort of platform over it and continued to live in the same place. Rather strange. There are no real cemeteries at all. Nobody's ever found a classic Maya cemetery. They buried beneath the houses or beneath the pyramids, beneath structures always.
Some of the cities that I read about in your book, The Royal Cities of the Ancient Maya, are gigantic. They're huge. And the question, you do raise the question in the book about how they supported so many people.
Well, yes. What's really strange is that some of the oldest of these cities are the biggest that occur right at the beginning of Maya civilization. Mm-hmm. For instance, the great city of El Mirador, which is north of Tikal, it's right almost over into Mexico, the northern border of Guatemala. It's absolutely the most gigantic city ever put up by the Maya, but it's also the earliest. Right at the beginning, how did they support a place like that, support their people? And apparently what happened about before the classic Maya began, about 100 or 200 A.D., there was a huge climate change took place in the Maya lowlands. And what happened is all their water sources dried up, their agriculture must have collapsed. The big question is, on a thing like that, what kind of agriculture did they practice? Today, the Maya, if they farm at all, farm using slash-and-burn agriculture, which is shifting. You cut down a stretch of forest, let it dry out, burn it off, and then plant in the ashes. And when, after 2 or 3 years, you get too many weeds or the fertility drops, then you cut another stretch of forest down. We think that this is what the Maya did, and it's a mystery that you could they supported such big populations this way. But it's probably more productive than people have thought. There's no real permanent form of agriculture in the Maya lowlands in the past. It was always slash and burn. And they did a lot of agricultural terracing if they could in sort of hilly areas. So
which is pretty sophisticated.
It's pretty darn sophisticated. It means a real knowledge of engineering of water resources. There's a lot of work recently done on this. Very interesting. They controlled this, but they got to a point where they couldn't control it anymore. The climate had just changed so much on them, and all these other things happened. So it would have collapsed. To calculate populations is very difficult, though. We have no censuses from this time. You have to make a big, rough guess. How many people could have been supported by that kind of agriculture in a given territory? And then how many, you can count their house mounds and say how many people lived in these houses at any one time. And then sort of make some multiplication, come up with some figures. But they're all inaccurate. Inherently inaccurate. We just don't know. Certainly, no Maya city had, let's say, 500,000 or a million people in it. On the other hand, these really big cities must have had somewhere between 50 and 100,000 people in them.
You were talking earlier about the destruction of some of the cities. That was one of the clues to perhaps the fact that revolution brought about the downfall of the classical Maya. And I was wondering, when I visited some of those areas in the past, they let you crawl all over them. You could go anywhere you wanted. And it seemed foreign to me coming from the United States, where you aren't allowed to get too close to much of anything that's ancient.
Well, it depends on where you are.
Right.
If you're in northern Yucatan and the big sites up there, the big cities, or even the little ones like Tulum on the east coast, mm-hmm. which tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, tourists visit every year.
Right.
They don't allow this anymore. You can't crawl around. When I first got down there in 1947, 1948, you could go anywhere and really climb every pyramid if you wanted mm-hmm. to, and nobody blew a whistle at you or anything. Today, it's very strictly controlled. If you want to crawl around the ruins today, you better go find one that is not generally accessible to tourists, because if they are, there are very strict rules about this. They know that human feet just by themselves, you know, tromping over these places are destructive. And so they're all very well controlled now, I can guarantee you.
Michael Coe, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been very interesting.
Thank you for inviting me. This has been enjoyable.
Michael Coe is professor emeritus in anthropology at Yale University. He's the author of many books about Maya culture, including his latest. It's called The Royal Cities of the Ancient Maya. Just want to wish all of our listeners a very, very happy holidays coming up and thank the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Corinne Gleckler, production assistants Katie Higgins and Leticia Wiggins, Rose Joe as well, with video production by Rich and Amber Karsmitsky. Also, Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrolak, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com. For more information on underwriting, call 614-292-9678.